All right, so my name is Katie Crook, and I'm here with the Southern Oral History Program, and the day is March 20th, 2014, and I'm here with Dr. Phelps Gates and his partner Ian at his home, and we are going to begin our interview. So, Phelps, if you don't mind if I call you that.
Please do, yes.
So I'd like to start with you just telling me a little bit about yourself. So maybe where you grew up, what your family was like, where you went to school.
Okay, I was born in Los Angeles. But at age 3, the family moved to Boston. My father was circulation manager of the Christian Science Monitor. And I grew up in Boston from age 3 to, about 12. And at age 12, went away to boarding school at Phillips Exeter Academy.
And where was that?
In New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire. Yeah.
And then went to college at Harvard and majored in classics. Did graduate work at Princeton, where I got involved in linguistics. And got a National Defense Fellowship at Princeton because I figured that studying ancient languages was somehow vital to the national defense.
And how did you come to that conclusion?
This was just after Sputnik went up.
Okay.
And they were very much into scholarships that had purported defense values. So studying Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit somehow got me a full fellowship at Princeton.
That's so interesting.
Then I went and taught at University of California at Davis, starting in 1965. And finally finished my dissertation in 1970 and came and joined the Classics Department, Classics and Linguistics Program here at UNC.
And what was your dissertation on?
I was on kinship terminology in Homeric Greek.
Wow.
Sand.
Very interesting. I was wondering if we could go back for a minute.
Sure.
Maybe could you tell me a little bit about what your family was like? Did you have brothers and sisters, or what was your relationship like with your parents?
I had two sisters who were both about 10 years older than I am.
Okay.
They're actually half-sisters, my father's children. And they sort of brought me up. My older sister, Anne, who graduated from the University of Chicago with straight A's and decided that the thing that she could do that would annoy her parents most, or our parents most, was to join the circus, which she did.
Oh, my gosh.
And she became a lion tamer with the circus. There's a picture of her over there somewhere taming lions.
And oh, wow.
She says, yep, the two girls sort of treated me as a little doll.
Oh, 10 years younger.
10 years younger. So.
Wow. And did you know when you were growing up that you were gay?
Not really, until I was about 12 or 13, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that I was attractive to other boys as much as to girls.
Did you come out to your family then, or did they know?
Well, they probably suspected. I never discussed it with my father, who died when I was at Princeton. Mm-hmm. But I came out formally to my mother. It must have been in the late 70s or early 80s. And I said, Mother, there's something I should tell you. I'm gay. And she said, oh, I've known that for years. I'm not as dumb as I look.
Oh, so she was tolerant of it.
Oh, yeah. It was not an issue. Yeah.
But you felt like maybe your father wouldn't have been.
Of course, that was a different era. And I think he would have been dismayed rather than anything else.
I've heard that before, that especially men with their fathers, that was more of a strict relationship, maybe.
Yes.
Okay, good. So I was wondering, so you went to Princeton and Harvard, and then you went all the way out to California.
Yes.
I was wondering what the geographical differences were like in terms of, like, was there a gay community when you went to college, or how was it in California, or what was compare and contrast, maybe?
Everybody was very much in the closet.
Okay.
And certainly at Harvard, I knew a couple of gay guys, but nobody was out, and it was all a deep, dark secret. At Princeton, I knew a few more people. Is this picking up on the microphone?
Yeah, this is
perfect. We used to go up to New York on weekends, or I used to go up to New York on weekends, visit gay bars there, and I knew a couple of people, and everybody was very much afraid that it would be publicized.
Right.
And then again, coming out, it's 1965, went out to Davis, and there was not much social life of any kind at Davis.
Okay.
But again, I would take the bus or drive down to San Francisco on the weekends. And there was a lot of stuff going on. Things were just beginning to take off in terms of a gay community in San Francisco at that time.
Okay.
And coming here in the 70s, again, people tended to be in the closet. Now, I got married to a woman in 1973,
really?
Yes, which turned out, she was a lesbian. So everything, seemed like a good idea at the time. But we got divorced after a year when it did not seem like a good idea. I'm still on good terms with her. Every now and then she'll come to town and we'll have lunch or something.
What made you decide to want to get married to her?
It just seemed right at the time. And there was a certain aura of social acceptance going mm-hmm. along with that.
And how old were you at that time?
I was, let's see, that was 73. I've been now 33.
Okay, so maybe you felt like the social pressure to
get married. There was some social pressure, and everybody in the department said, "Oh, how great Phelps was getting married, and isn't his wife?"
So they didn't know that you were gay.
Some of them did. It was just never brought up, mm-hmm. and
I've heard that before. That just wasn't talked.
It just wasn't talked about it in that era.
Right. And so what made you decide, well, you kind of told me what made you decide to study classics.
Yeah.
What made you decide to want to become a professor in classics?
Well, if you study classics, you're going to end up as a professor.
It's the only thing you can do.
I mean, that's really what the job market is.
Let me see. Okay, so you came to UNC in 1971. And so that was the year after kind of the sexual revolution began on campus. There was, in 1970, in Morrison Dormitory, there was like a sexual awareness month, and things were really starting to get started. Were you aware much of that while you
were
professing?
Not at all.
Okay.
And of course, as a faculty member, it would have been very awkward for me to be involved with undergraduate gay activities as well.
Were you aware of the gay community at Chapel Hill at the time? Or was this before people started being more?
I was not really aware at that time. I became more and more aware as I met gay people through several gay people I met through Alcoholics Anonymous when I got sober in 1974.
Okay. Yes, we're definitely going to get to that. Let's see. So one thing that I wanted to ask you, we did an interview with Cecil Wooten. Did you know him in the classics department?
Cedric Whitman?
Cecil Wooten.
Oh, Cecil Wooten.
Yeah.
Oh, I knew him very well. He was best man at my wedding.
No way!
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about him.
He was an interesting guy. And he was sort of the first out gay person that I knew of in classics or on the faculty in general. And he, I guess, became the advisor of the gay student group, didn't he?
Yes,
my recollection of that was.
The Carolina Gay Association.
Carolina Gay Association. Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, I knew Cecil. And I guess got to know him better after coming out here.
Right.
But
in the interview that we did with him, he talked about there being a tension between his homosexuality and his professional life. He said something like, "I didn't feel like I could be a gay man and a professor." Did you feel
there was a lot of that, and that my getting married was probably associated with that.
Okay,
yeah.
So maybe could you tell me a little bit more about that tension that you felt at the time?
That it would be like being a poster child almost,
mm-hmm.
being the gay classics professor.
Oh, okay, I understand.
And
so you wanted to kind of not be there.
Sort of be under the radar.
Under the radar.
As it were, yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Oh, and I found a bio on you or something somewhere that said that you left, or maybe, no, you emailed me that you left UNC in 1979.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit more about why you left, maybe? Or?
Okay. In 1977, I think, I bought one of those early personal computers. And I said, wow, this is a lot of fun. Because I had done some work with computers in academia, doing linguistic studies of documents. But here I had the entire computer to play with all by myself. And I looked around for various worthwhile projects and started implementing computer languages, and APL and Pascal and a couple of other language interpreters. And sent some of them off to a publishing company, and this was all very early days when they would have guys set up as software companies with maybe one employee and 50 customers, and one of these was APL. And this came to the attention of a company in Rockville, Maryland, called STSC, which specialized in APL on mainframes. And they could see that mainframes were going to be gradually phased out in favor of personal computers. And they were looking for somebody to implement an APL language interpreter for them. And out of the blue, they called me up and said, can we come down and check out your APL program, which they did. And out of the blue, they offered me a job, which paid twice as much as I was getting as an associate professor of classics and linguistics.
Right. So how did your classics training kind of play into that?
It was the linguistics training more than anything else.
Okay.
Of the structure of languages.
Okay.
And because computer languages are languages.
Mm-hmm.
And writing computer a computer language is in effect a computer program which translates from the instructions you give the computer to what the computer itself sees on the other end. And linguistics training paid off in that department.
Wow. So. That is so interesting. So what did you find, since you went from teaching in this professor, this, you know, kind of, not really artistic, but humanities world, to technology, what did you find the difference in maybe like acceptance or tolerance of gays to be from one world to the other?
I'm not sure there was that much difference. It never really came up that much, again, in the computer company, partly because I was telecommuting. The company was in Rockville, Maryland, and I was working here. These were the days when you would ring up the computer and it would go beep, 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 and you would jam the telephone into the little rubber cups. Do you remember those things?
Yeah, and a while ago.
We did operate at 300 baud, and I would program something and then upload it over, take about like an hour to upload the program.
So you never came into very much like personal contact with people?
Every couple of months I would go up and have a conference with them and fly up and fly back.
So it was not something that was ever really discussed?
I was not, yeah. And I did meet another gay guy who worked in the same branch of the company. I've forgotten exactly. And we sort of dropped hints to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Or drop pearls, as the expression used to be. And he ended up taking me out to some gay bars in Washington.
How was that?
More lively than the gay scene around Chapel Hill,
I'll
say that.
Okay. How did the gay scene in Chapel Hill compare to, say, San Francisco or even New York, where you were?
There really was not a gay scene in Chapel Hill as such. There used to be a gay bar on Henderson Street.
The Tempo Room?
The Tempo Room, yes.
Yeah, we talked about that. Did it burn down? I think it burned down.
Did it? There was a fire there, yeah.
Yeah.
And, okay, I think it's became where Sadlacks was. And even Sadlacks is gone now.
Yeah, I don't think it's there.
But I never had the nerve to go into the Temple Room. And there was also a gay bar in Durham.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there were a couple of gay bars in Durham.
I'd heard that people often went from Chapel Hill to Durham.
Yeah.
There
was some
gay
activity.
In the other places, there were a lot more gay bars and a lot more activity.
And there were a couple in Raleigh. One, the Glitter Gulch, I guess, was all still in business in those days.
Okay. was, I wanted to ask, because I think this plays into what we're going to talk about later about alcoholism and substance abuse. Right. I know when I interviewed Dr. Carmichael, he said a lot of the reason why gay men were alcoholics, or part of the reason, is because you could only meet in bars.
That could be, although...
What do you think about that?
I don't think that was really a factor in my case.
Okay.
Because I preferred drinking at home in the peace and quiet of my living room,
right,
rather than out at bars.
Right. Well, let's go ahead and get to that then, if you don't mind me asking.
Oh.
How did you become, you know, an abuser of alcoholism? How did that come about?
It just gradually got me over the years. Mm-hmm. I started drinking when I was in graduate school, and would use it as medication to... I had a hard time finishing my dissertation, and I would sit there in Davis, California, saying, oh, why can't I get this thesis finished? Pour me a drink. So
mm-hmm.
I would go on that.
And that's how it started.
And that's how it went on.
So did it have anything to do with your identity as a gay man?
I don't think really. It was
okay.
It was more of a general, perhaps a genetic factor.
Okay. And how so? Was anybody in your family?
Most of them were teetotalers,
oh,
which was probably significant, except for cousin Pete, who was sort of the black sheep of the family, ended up in Guam, and I think he may have been an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. So there could have been a genetic component, maybe. Then.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about how you got involved in the gay AA meeting.
Oh, okay. Well, let me tell you how I got involved in AA in the first place.
Yeah, please do.
Which was kind of a strange story. On a Sunday afternoon, I was working in my office and came out of the office and happened to run into a graduate student that I knew. And he was walking with a friend of his. And we talked for a little while. And... then the other guy walked off, and the graduate student said, you know, that guy used to be a terrible alcoholic, but he's gotten sober. And that sort of set off a little bell in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day I called him up and said, I had known somehow that Alcoholics Anonymous was the place to go if you were... if you had trouble with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And the graduate student said, yeah, he used to be a terrible alcoholic, but he joined Alcoholics Anonymous and he hasn't had a drink. And in fact, they had discussed that when I was talking with two of them. The graduate student said to him, Jim, I haven't seen you around, Mike Musmulis. What's the name of that place downtown?
I'm not sure.
There was a I get it's probably even closed, right? Closed now.
It might be.
But
he
said, I haven't seen you around that bar lately. And Jim said, no, I've been sober for 8 months. So anyhow, I called up Jim the next day, and he said, yes, would you like me to come and see you? And which flabbergasted me that the idea that someone would. By this time, my wife had left.
Okay.
This was in June of 74.
And you were in Chapel Hill at this
point. I was in Chapel Hill. I was living in a house out in the country, out on Old 54.
Okay.
And my wife had had enough, and she left. And I called up Jim Lewis, who's now deceased. And he offered to come see me, and I said, well, I'll come see you tomorrow, which I did. And I discovered, incidentally, that the reason he was on campus is that the basement of Murphy Hall on campus used to be the gay activity spot on campus.
Really?
Yes. And
tell
people,
me about that.
You didn't know about
that? No.
This is,
I've never heard that one.
You know where Murphy Hall
is. Of course, I have classes in there.
And they've redecorated it, and I think the basement is no longer active. But people used to come from out of town and ask people, how do I get to Murphy's basement? As it was the name of a bar.
Oh, my
But the basement men's room in Murphy used to be the hot meeting place on campus. And that's what Jim was doing on campus. He was cruising the basement men's room in Murphy Hall, because he himself was gay, mm-hmm. even though he was married and had three children.
Really?
And anyhow, I came to meet him at his house the next day, and he took me to a meeting that night, and things progressed from there. I have not had a drink since that day.
Good. So, congratulations. The AA meeting. Now, where were they held exactly? Was this in the Newman Center?
The gay meetings. Okay, the gay meetings got started, I think, 3 or 4 years after that.
Okay.
And the feeling sort of was that gay people needed a place where they could talk about issues that were bothering them without that other people might not understand.
Right.
And people were a lot more open in about being gay in AA. In fact, that's where I first started meeting a number of gay people.
Really?
Because the idea of being alcoholic sort of overshadowed everything else. You could say, well, I'm gay, and that's not that big a deal. And also things were getting more open in general in the mid-70s.
At this time?
We met for the first time in a guy's house, or in his apartment, which was over Cliff's Meat Market in Carborough. Do you know where that is?
I do know where that is.
And yep. he lived in an apartment over Cliff's Meat Market. His name was Juan. He was actually Spanish. Came from Spain originally. And he left for San Francisco about a year after the gay group started and hasn't been heard from since. So I don't know whatever became of him.
Yeah.
But we met in his apartment for, several months.
Mm-hmm.
And then we looked around for places to meet. And the Newman Center was staffed mostly by gay priests at that time.
Really?
And this was the time when they had kicked Dignity, the gay Catholic group, out of the Newman Center, some mm-hmm. places like that.
Right.
And I think the priests were happy to have another gay group meeting there. And it was all right for us because we didn't claim to be Catholic.
Yeah.
And we just rented the space from them at a nominal fee.
How long did the meetings go on there? Are they still going on there?
No, they stopped. We met there, I guess, must have been 6 or 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
But things sort of petered out for a number of reasons. A lot of people several people moved to San Francisco. A number of people died of AIDS. We had a number of people who got sick and died. And also, it dwindled down to a small group of people. I guess Jim Carmichael was one of the last members. And by that time, the feeling was that we didn't really need a gay AA meeting.
Mm-hmm.
That people could talk about gay issues as much in regular meetings as they could anyplace else. Also, one of the motivations for the group getting started was the idea of a gay community and of gay separatism and that sort of feeling. And that sort of at least partially faded away because there was much less of a gay separatism feeling by the 80s.
So I'm wondering if this gay separatist feeling, where that stemmed from, was that because the Chapel Hill community wasn't accepting, per se?
There's part of that. And it's also the, I guess, us versus them feeling of something special for as a gay society.
And this would have been in the mid-70s?
In the mid to late 70s,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, and I wanted to ask you, in these groups, and eventually you became a leader, or were you just a part of it?
I was, it's like a rotating leadership.
Okay.
And I think I was the chairman for several years.
Okay.
And Jim Carmichael, I think, was the chairman he sort of took over.
Yeah, I think so. I think you talked about that. What were these meetings like? What kinds of things did people struggle with other than their alcoholism? Did their identity have anything to do with it?
It was in many cases, or issues with relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard even to remember at this point what we talked about in meetings. And the general feel... You know about how AA works, I take it.
If you could refresh my memory.
It's basically people come to meetings and talk about, as the expression goes, their experience, strength, and hope. And people talk about what their experiences have been. And there'll be a topic of, usually of some, like gratitude, for example, or how are we going to survive Christmas, or things like that. Okay. And people will talk about how this related to their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot, since as gay people, a lot of these things related to our lives as gay people, mm-hmm. we were able to talk about them in ways which we would have felt a little awkward at non-gay meetings.
Mm-hmm. So was everyone who went to these meetings, were they all gay? Or were there any straight people there too?
Everybody at the meetings was always gay,
okay.
as I recall, yes.
Was it a spoken or unspoken kind of rule that they were, this was the gay AA meeting versus just an AA meeting?
We called it the Lambda group.
Remember
when Lambda was a
yes.
code signal for gay? And we were in the directory for everything. We were listed in the local AA directory as Lambda group, parenthesis, gay, as I recall.
Oh, so people knew that this was...
Oh, yeah. Everybody knew it was the gay meeting. And I think we might, occasionally, a straight person might have come by mm-hmm. and blundered in, but I don't think that happened on a regular basis.
What was the sponsorship like? Did you have sponsors in AA?
Oh, the concept of AA sponsorship?
Yeah.
My original sponsor was straight. And my later sponsor became Jim Lewis, the married guy
yeah.
that I had met for the first time. He was an interesting character that died about 15 years ago. His wife, it's kind of a strange phenomenon. Because Jim and I had sex occasionally,
mm-hmm.
and which makes, I guess, him into an adulterer with yeah. as far as his wife's concerned. But his wife and I became very good friends, and she died just a couple of months ago.
Aww.
And I would visit her once a week in the nursing home for several years.
Yeah. Did they remain married, or did she ever know?
I think it was one of these don't ask, don't tell
mm-hmm.
things. And she probably knew that he, yeah. that he was gay. And she certainly knew that he was gay because he lost his job in government in the 1950s for being gay. You know,
communism?
A witch hunt, one of those gay witch hunts
in
the 50s. He was a librarian in Washington, D.C., as I recall. And he was brought in one day and informed that he would no longer had a job because somebody that he knew had outed him as gay. He was born in 1920, so he would have been in his 30s. You're too young to remember the 50s, but I mean,
right.
you think things were closeted in the
right.
70s. It was ridiculous.
I'm actually doing an honors thesis on the Red Scare in North Carolina, so this
okay.
is really interesting.
This was in Washington.
So, right.
And he came down here and got various degrees at UNC, a Romance Languages degree.
Did you ever, just to get off topic for a second, but did you ever experience any of that, like, kind of Red Scare communist, because you were a gay man? Did you ever feel threatened or anything?
Not in those terms, no. And from what I've read, a lot of the Red Scare was really a gay scare
mm-hmm.
in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I don't recall that being an issue.
For you?
For me, you know. Okay. I do remember applying for a job at the University of Texas, and one of the things they asked was, what organizations do you belong to? And I said, well, the Book of the Month Club. But I think that's not quite what they're looking for.
Okay, well, that was good to know. Let's see. How did the people, to go back to the AA meetings in the Newman Center, you said that it was kind of advertised. Is that how people found out?
I think most of the people would see it in the directory. Or people who knew, were friends of friends, would come in.
Did you guys actively say, go to the bottom of Murphy and say, hey, if you have a problem, like, come see us?
No, that,
did you?
We did not advertise in gay bars or Murphy Hall or anything like that.
Okay. Good to know. And at this point, I know we've touched on this a little bit, but were people coming out, per se, at this point? Was there more of an acceptance of people saying, hey, I'm gay, and it was okay?
It was becoming more and more accepted, certainly in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever feel like you could come out to more people later on in your life?
You mean by the 1980s or 90s? Yeah. Eventually just stopped being an issue.
Yeah.
And
okay. And I wanted to ask you this. I'm glad you brought it up a few minutes ago because it was actually one of my questions about the AIDS epidemic. Because
yes.
Dr. Carmichael was telling me about how you did lose a lot of people from your group to AIDS. Can you tell me a little bit about kind of your fears or what happened in the 1980s at that time?
Well, it was definitely a time of serious worry. Mm-hmm. And I knew quite a few people who died during that period. Mm-hmm. And it was just the terror lurking in the lurking out there in the woods somewhere.
Yeah. And did you know at that time what was causing it, or was it just this blanket fear?
Nobody really knew quite what was causing it until the mid-80s, and there were various theories. Well, it was amyl nitrate or stuff like that. I said, well, I'm all right because I don't take amyl nitrate, and then we know somebody who had it and did not do that. Mm-hmm. But eventually it became clear what the causes were. And at that time, you see, it didn't come to North Carolina until like the mid-80s, and there would be, we would, or at least I would look in the gay newspapers, and it would say, there was a column in the New York Native, which was a gay newspaper at the time, which read, taking Larry Kramer's title 1,000 and so on, and counting, and they had a list of the number of cases per state. Mm-hmm. And I would look in that column each week and see, well, we only got 22 cases in North Carolina. Maybe we're going to escape it. And then, as the years went on, that became less and less comforting because as the number of cases went up.
Do you remember about what year the number of cases went up, the mid-80s?
It was the mid-80s when things began to be...
Did that kind of spark a fear in you at the time?
A little bit, although I wasn't getting much sex at that time, which probably saved my life. Yeah.
Right. So you didn't know at the time that it was sexually transmitted?
It was generally pretty clear by that time that it was sexually transmitted. Mm-hmm. And,
I wanted to ask you about, you just mentioned gay newspapers.
Yes.
Before the advent of the internet, when you can get everything over the internet, how did you find gay newspapers? Were they widely publicized, or did you have to hunt them down?
Each newspaper would advertise in other newspapers. And I remember seeing gay newspapers in San Francisco, and then I brought some with me, and then I would subscribe. And I was never worried about the mailman knowing that I was gay. they came in plain brown envelopes anyway. But I got them through subscriptions myself. And of course, the bars, all there would be the giveaway newspapers in the bars.
Okay.
There was the North Carolina, the front page was the name of the one in North Carolina.
Okay.
Which I guess the victim of the internet.
Yeah. So you said at least early on when you first came here, there was not much activity. Were there more gay bars as you went along, or did the gay community ever, when did it flourish,
I don't think ever really flourished in terms of gay bars around here. Mm-hmm. I ended up finding sex partners at the rest area on Interstate 85, where the truck way station is now.
Yes, that, I drive through there all the time.
That used to be a rest area.
Okay.
And sort of by informal word of mouth, people would discover that would be a place to meet other gay men. And it was relatively safe. I never heard of anybody being arrested there. Mm-hmm. But you would go there and sit on the benches as if you were having a picnic at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And people would drive past, and you would either go off into the woods for sex, mm-hmm. or go to their house, for example.
So I take it that you might have, was it hard finding partners at this time? I mean, you had to drive all the way out to 85.
Well, it was only a 25-minute drive.
Yeah, yeah.
that was worth it. But I mean, there was a lot less sex, I think, than there is now.
Probably because people weren't as open.
People weren't as open, and of course, people were worried about AIDS.
Right.
So.
Okay. Were there any other, I know you said the bottom of Murphy, this rest area on 85, maybe some bars that were, where were some other places where you could meet partners?
You would meeting people in AA was an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I met a lot of people, or other social situations.
And what was the dating life like? Was it, you meet up to have sex, or did people have long-term relationships at this time, or what was... What was that scene like?
I think it was different for different people. I had only one long-term relationship during this period, long-term in terms of a couple of years,
right,
with someone that I, in fact, met at the rest area.
Really?
I-85, yeah.
Okay. So, do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Well, this was Fagley. Did you look him up in the...
I didn't have a chance to. No, I didn't. Tell me about him.
Very interesting character. He was the first person to apply for gay marriage license.
In North Carolina?
In Washington State in 1971. And, of course, he was laughed out of the office, but... Are we still going strong?
Oh, we're good.
Okay.
We're good.
And he became the subject of a famous lawsuit, which is discussed in the Wikipedia article.
I'm going to have to look this up.
And he was awarded, he was discriminated against because he insisted on wearing a dress to work.
So and he's a trans.
No, he just thought that would annoy people.
Oh.
So he annoyed people enough to get fired for that, and he filed a sexual discrimination suit, which he eventually won and collected large amounts of money, which he lived on for. He was living on that at the time when I met him.
And where did you meet him?
I met him at the rest area.
Oh, the rest stop, that's right.
In like, about 1978.
Okay.
His original name was John Singer, and he changed his name to Fagel Ben Miriam to annoy people. And
it's quite a name.
He was very, very much of an in-your-face gay activist.
Mm-hmm.
And like the planetarium here put up a Star of Bethlehem to advertise their Star of Bethlehem planetarium show. Do they still have that?
I've never heard of it.
If they don't have it, it's because Fagela complains so loudly they take it down. At Moorhead Planetarium, yeah. And I guess they no longer do a Star of Bethlehem show there. And he also complained to the Advocate, the gay magazine, because they sent their magazines in plain brown wrappers, and he wanted his to be public to annoy the postman.
So he was unashamed. Completely.
Very, very much unashamed, and very much in your face, and I thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
So, but he eventually moved to Washington, moved back to Seattle.
Okay.
So,
how interesting. He sounds like quite
a... Read the Wikipedia
article. Yeah, he sounds like quite an interesting...
Interesting character.
Interesting character. To go back to the meetings for a second, I've read that even today there are not very many studies on lesbian substance abuse. Back when you were doing AA in the Newman Center, did any lesbians show up?
I don't believe we ever had a lesbian show up.
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
I
don't. It was just a separate community entirely, and there was a lesbian bar in Durham, the Clown's Inn.
Okay.
Does that name ring a bell with you?
I hadn't heard of it, but then again, we haven't been able to find too many lesbians.
It was behind a gas station. It was both gay men and lesbians. And I only visited there once when they had a going away party for Fagela in 1979.
Oh yeah.
But again, there was very somewhat closeted because I'm a gay bar underneath a gas station.
Yeah.
I mean, really. So.
Out of the way.
Yeah.
Well, on the topic of lesbians, could we go back and talk a little bit maybe about your wife?
Okay. To say she was a lesbian was, she was bisexual,
okay.
I would say. And she was, she was a graduate student in classics when I was teaching linguistics here.
Okay.
And we got to know each other, and one thing led to another,
yeah.
And somehow...
Was she involved in anything on campus because she was a student here?
I don't think so.
Okay. So, I don't think there was as much for lesbian or bisexual.
Yeah.
I guess it's not as ironic now that I know that there were gay priests, but I was thinking before the interview that Catholicism and religion in general oftentimes takes a stance against the gay community. And I was wondering if the irony of meeting in the Catholic Newman Center, if there was any kind of juxtaposition
there. There may have been some poetic irony intended there. But again, we had two priests who often attended our meeting. And I mean, if they throw out all the gay priests, the church would have to shut down. Probably half the priests in the Catholic Church are gay.
Really?
And certainly the ones at the Newman Center were.
Really?
And
did they also have alcohol problems? Is that why they were there?
Yes. They,
or,
were,
okay.
they were in the group because they were gay alcoholic priests. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did anybody, I know Dr. Carmichael, and it seems like from your experience too, that the AA meetings were more than just the AA meetings, that they were, you know, a space for the gay community.
Was true, yeah. And we socialized with each other a lot.
Right.
Yes.
Was there anybody there who maybe didn't have a problem, that just an alcohol problem, just wanted to come and be part of this gay community? Or did everybody have...
At least everybody claimed that they did.
I'm
sure...
Yeah, probably wouldn't be there if they didn't.
I don't think they would have been there if they hadn't been.
Were the only component of the meetings the actual meeting space, or did you guys ever have maybe parties or go out and do other...
We would sometimes get together on an individual basis and do things.
Okay. Great. Let's see. Okay, well, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the gay community today, and I think we've touched on it a little bit.
Oh.
But even in the last maybe 3 to 5 years, have you noticed any kind of change here?
I don't know. We're not really involved in the gay community as such at all. I mean, I haven't been to a gay bar in 30 years, probably.
Yeah.
And, our friends are gay, straight, whatever. It's just not a... the whole concept of the gay community seems like something that was outdated almost.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
At least for us.
I read an article, as I was Googling your name, I read an article about gay and gray. Is that...
Oh.
What is that about?
There is some movement toward senior gays. There's an organization called SAGE, SAGE, which originally stood for Seniors in a Gay Environment. Although they've changed their name to something snappier, but I don't remember what it is now. But their website, I'm sure, will tell you. And they organized a meeting at the Senior Center about 6 months ago for gay seniors to get together. And we attended the first meeting, but it just did not seem like anything that we were interested in. They talked about things like getting together for to play games or things like that, or watch movies together.
So there is a little bit of a movement, maybe, to bring people together, but maybe not as engaging.
It didn't click with us somehow, and I think it's a really small group.
Yeah. So I guess it's interesting because when I see Chapel Hill now, I do see quite a gay community that coalesces and does things. So
it may be more for young people.
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in.
Are you yourself gay?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
But I do, you know, have plenty of gay friends. And, I see, so I'm interested in this kind of maybe like generational gap.
There is a generational
thing.
Because most people we know are our age or close to it.
Okay.
And
do you think that young people have more of a need to be in a group setting like that?
Probably, I don't know if they have more of a need. I think they probably have more of an interest in it.
Yeah. Definitely. Do you think that there's any work that needs to be done for Chapel Hill in terms of tolerance or acceptance or anything like that?
Certainly in my experience, I haven't seen any acceptance problems in recent years.
Did there ever used to be?
Well, the only unaccepting encounter I ever had was somebody who called up the telephone number. We were listening to the AA directory, and he called up the number and wanted to know where an AA meeting was, and I told him where our meeting was, and I said, it is a gay and lesbian meeting, you know. And he said something unpleasant, and I said, I'm sorry you feel that way. He hung up in annoyance.
Yeah.
So it was mostly people who were, like, surprised at encountering it. But I have never, like, encountered any direct bigotry.
Okay, yeah. Good. So no direct hostility or anything. Were you aware of the, this just came to me, it was the Southeastern, I think, Gay and Lesbian Conference?
Oh, yes. In fact, I think I attended some sessions of that, yes.
Do you remember anything about that?
I don't remember it that clearly.
I think it was in the 70s on campus.
Yes, yeah, yeah. You remember, were you here for that, Ian? The Southeastern Gay and Lesbian thing?
They were an annual event for some years in the 70s and into the 80s at least.
Yes. Okay. That's what Dr. Carmichael had mentioned.
Yes.
That too. And I guess, Phelps, you weren't a part of necessarily the Carolina Gay Association or anything like that.
I was not involved in the Carolina Gay Association. Ian, you were involved in that, were you?
I went to UNC and there was a Carolina Gay Association at the time. This would be the mid to late 70s. And I would go to some of their meetings, mm-hmm. which are the usual boring mm-hmm. stuff. And occasionally bursts of activism, and then there would be social events like dances.
Right. Did you ever find that to be very helpful, or was it just kind of an annoyance?
Oh, no, it was helpful.
It was?
Entirely, yes. Just to meet other gay
right.
undergraduates and graduate students. The occasional teacher would come by.
Okay. What was the demographic like? Because I had heard that it was... I'd heard conflicting stories. It was young people. It was older people. who was there at these meetings? At the Carolina Gay Association meetings?
Usually students.
Hmm.
Yes.
That's what I thought.
Oh.
Okay.
You didn't have to be a student even to attend. I mean, somebody would just drop in over an evening and meeting other gay people and that sort of thing. I think we had pretty regular sort of social hours on Tuesday evenings at the Lutheran Church, I believe.
Okay. Interesting. Did not know that. Let me see. Oh, I also heard, or I read, that, Mark Kleinschmidt, the mayor of Chapel
right.
Hill, I saw that you supported him financially because his records.
Oh, is that?
Public.
Oh, never.
Yeah.
You can't get away with anything
no,
these days.
So that leads me to the question of, do you feel yourself? Where's your political stance on some of these issues that have been brought up in recent years with the gay marriage and gays in the military and stuff like that?
Well, I certainly support gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And gays in the military, all the way.
Do you feel that the country is taking steps in the right direction?
Certainly a lot more than I ever thought possible.
Really?
And especially in the last 4 or 5 years with gay marriage becoming
yeah.
more and more
accepted.
And legal in like 20-some states, I think, now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you feel a couple years ago with Amendment 1? Were you...
Well, that was very discouraging.
That was
it was discouraging, to say the least. Although, certainly around in this neighborhood, and I guess in Chapel Hill as a whole, we would see signs down with Amendment, saying no on Amendment 1.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it got many votes in Chapel Hill.
Yeah. Do you think that there, in your lifetime, that maybe North Carolina will be more accepting of gay marriage?
Well, I think it's certainly moving in that direction. And when it is overturned, it'll be overturned in the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably within 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. That'd be great. Let's see. So what was to go off a little of that, what was the legislation like back in the, 1970s or 80s? Was being gay ever talked about in the courts, or was it ever part of kind of this national dialogue?
Well, of course, it was illegal to be gay. And it's still, the crime against nature law is still on the books.
Right.
Although I don't think anybody's been arrested lately.
I don't think so either. Were they arrested back in the 70s and 80s?
Occasionally. There were... I don't remember any big witch hunts, but there were... I knew one guy in AA in Durham who had been arrested and had various problems. This was back in the 1960s that he had his trouble.
Mm-hmm. Could people be arrested at the rest stops or the gay bars, or did anything like that?
I never heard of anybody being arrested at this rest stop. The rest stop in Greensboro would occasionally have police raids where they would come and roust people. I don't know if they actually arrested them or not.
Mm-hmm.
And Were there ever raids at gay bars in this area, Ian?
Not in our time,
So do you think that that's because people didn't know what was going on, or were the police going to turn a blind eye to it, maybe?
They had other things to worry about.
Yeah. I would assume that would be the case. So one thing that I've kind of gotten a sense for is that a lot of people, straight, gay, what have you, kind of consider their sexual identity oftentimes to be their only identity, or that, you know, I am gay, I am straight, that's my identity. How does your sexuality play a role in your overall conception of who you are?
It's just one aspect of my personality.
Just one aspect. How would you personally describe yourself? Where would gay fall on that list?
Well, to stay sober, I have to be an alcoholic first, and then gay somewhere down the list.
Okay. So that personality comes through a lot more?
Yes.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you maybe about some of your other interests outside of, you know, what we've been talking about. What kinds of things do you like to do?
I enjoy hiking. I go walk 5 miles every morning.
Wow.
Hiked the Appalachian Trail a few years ago.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Wow. Congratulations.
Well, thanks to Ian, who would drive me to the trail and drop me off at one mile post, and I would pick you up a few hours later at another one.
Wow.
So, and I even got Ian out on the trail a few times.
Really? So, how long did that take you?
It took me 5 years, but not all at once.
Not all at once.
But it was a 5-year project.
Wow. So, I saw somewhere that I don't know if you still are, but at least you were the leader of the barefoot hikers.
And we had a barefoot hikers group.
Tell me about that.
That was sort of a fun activity, but not an in-your-face kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Although I stopped doing barefoot hiking when I discovered that I could hike twice as far, twice as fast with shoes
with
on.
Shoes, yeah.
So, and creating acrostics is another one of my hobbies. It's a double acrostic. You may have seen them in newspapers. Let me show you.
But
let me see.
It's like these are to crossword puzzles what chess is to checkers, they say. It's a very clever puzzle thing, and I construct them is even harder than solving them. And there's a website called eCrostics that I send these off to.
Wow.
And there are a bunch of people who construct these and solve them as puzzles.
That's amazing.
Yes.
One thing that I didn't even get to that I obviously should have is, how did you guys meet?
Oh, we met at a dance.
At a dance?
A gender-neutral country dancing group that meets over in Durham on Thursday nights.
Tell me about that a little bit. Does it still meet?
Oh, yeah. We don't go much anymore, but we met there. And you know about country dancing, it's dancing like they did in Jane Austen's time.
Okay.
And
There's
a group, there are actually several groups around this area that do country dancing. And some of them have male and female partners. This is a gender neutral version.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fagula was active in this many years ago. And back at around 1999, I said, I noticed their ad in the paper. I said, I wonder if these guys are still going at it. So I call them up and started attending. And one night, Ian tweaked my beard and said, you have a nice beard. And one thing led to another. And
that was the beginning?
That was the beginning of a beautiful friendship, as
Aww.
They say. So.
And you, when you emailed me, you said that you guys are life partners. So you really feel like you found...
I think so.
Found
stable. We've been together since early 2001.
Congratulations.
So,
that's a beautiful story. Well, let me ask you, see if there's anything I didn't get to. I'm thinking, is there anything else that you would maybe like to share with me that we didn't necessarily get to?
I think we've covered the territory.
Great. Well, thank you so much. so much. Well, thank you so much.
I hope I was able to make a